This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In last week's Radio EcoShock show, Dr. Guy McPherson explained his scientific reasons why he thinks humans will become extinct before the year 2040. He outlined a combination of ecological collapse, already ongoing in the extinction of other species, a dying ocean, the prospect of abandoned or failing nuclear plants, and the overriding shift of Earth's climate. McPherson is a professor emeritus in natural science from the University of Arizona. He has collected masses of scientific papers, news articles, and statements to show the worst of all worlds is developing. Our next guest says Guy McPherson is wrong. Scott K. Johnson describes himself as a geoscience educator, hydrologist, and freelance science writer contributing at Ars Technica. His personal blog is at fractalplanet.wordpress.com. An article there has become a focal point for people questioning McPherson and the whole idea of near-term human extinction. Scott Johnson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, let's begin with this. Do you think climate change is real and presents a significant danger to humans and the natural world?
Oh, absolutely. I'm glad you asked me that out the gate, because I think some people who are very interested in what McPherson is saying kind of assume that any criticism must be coming from people who don't believe that climate change exists or something like that. So yes, in my work as a science writer, I cover, mainly the geosciences, but especially climate science. So I'm very frequently covering, the latest studies in that field.
And are you a scientist yourself?
I'm not, no. I have an academic background in groundwater, but I moved on from that. And so I work as a science writer currently.
Okay. Now, how did you discover Guy McPherson?
So, as someone who covers climate frequently, I often have interactions with people who leave comments on stories that are usually to the effect that it's all a bunch of hooey or something like that. But on a couple of occasions a few months ago, I had people who came in and said, oh, why aren't you telling the truth? Why are you soft-selling the problem of climate change, which was a bit of a shock to me, kind of a change of pace. And so these people were pointing me to Guy McPherson's blog, and I hadn't encountered it before, but they said, well, he says he's just passing along the science. Why do you reject that science or something like that? And I took a look at it, and when I looked around, I couldn't find any criticism of what he had written anywhere, and so I decided that I should do it. So I spent some time going through sort of his central post on his kind of evidence for his claims, and I tried to break down sort of the problems that I found there.
Why do you compare Guy McPherson to a climate skeptic? He obviously believes climate change is real.
Right, yeah, and it's not a position comparison that I've made, it's a stylistic one. Many of the things that climate skeptics do to make the arguments that they make is to kind of take things out of context, not assess the whole field, but, just look at one paper or something like that, to accuse climate scientists of some kind of bias or fraud or lying. And some of these same things kind of surprisingly show up in what Guy wrote. So that was something that sort of struck me, that I saw the same sorts of rhetorical dodges, if you want to put it that way.
Well, last week I asked Guy why he says we will go extinct so soon in the 2030s. He cited work by Malcolm Light and Sam Karana. I have problems with those sources. I've told him so publicly and privately. What do you think about the Arctic News blog as a credible source?
It's definitely not. It definitely is something that he's relied on quite a bit for most of his kind of more catastrophic pieces of support for his argument. The things that I've seen in that blog, which I was introduced to in, through this process, include a lot of really wild things. Like, I know recently I don't know which one of those fellows, but something about earthquakes around the Arctic, and indeed further down into, Alaska and maybe even in the Pacific Northwest. And these earthquakes are being caused by the loss of ice from Greenland. And I've heard them say before that, these earthquakes in the Arctic are somehow releasing vast stores of methane from the mantle. None of these things are things that are true. or even plausible. So they're really surprising things to run into. But sort of beyond that, there have been many, some of the things that guys refer to specifically as pieces of evidence, you know, things like projections of temperature change with, you know, rising methane concentrations or something like that. He points to them and he calls it analysis that shows this, but, you know, in one of these main cases, they take the average global concentration of methane roughly at present, and then they add in a single measurement from some day in the Arctic that's higher than that, which is natural because the methane is not uniform around the world. It's higher in the far northern hemisphere and lower in the southern hemisphere. So they take one sort of the highest measurement they can find from, you know, some point. And then they draw a line through those and say, see, it's increasing. And not only that, but they draw an exponential line through those things, which is not the wisest thing to do with 2 points. And so they'll draw this exponential curve and say, here's what methane's going to do, and that's going to have this effect on temperature. And Guy will cite that as if it's sort of a documented scientific finding, when really it's really sloppy.
Yeah, the only published source I found for near-term extinction other than Guy McPherson is Malcolm Light. Malcolm made a really strange prediction based on a quick release of methane from the Arctic. His so-called paper, though, Scott, is nothing more than a blog entry, in my opinion. It's never been peer-reviewed or published in a journal. Malcolm claims to know the year and even the very month when humans will become extinct in the northern hemisphere and a little later in the southern hemisphere. That kind of certainty in this complex world really sounds an alarm bell in my brain. It reminds me of the date given by religious apocalyptics like the Seventh-day Adventists. How about you? What's your take on that?
I would agree that it's definitely not a good sign. It's not the kind of thing that anyone could be confident about.
Well, I've published a blog outlining the many problems of using Malcolm Light as a source, and it includes his background and his fantastic visions like using HARP radio beams to turn atmospheric methane into diamonds. I'll put a link to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. I don't want to go over it again. Now, as another poster at Arctic News, Sam Karana isn't really a normal source for science either. He or she is an unknown quantity using the name Sam Karana on the internet. He or she makes really useful graphs and charts based on data from real institutes. Sometimes I appreciate that, but we can hardly put the name Karana and a year in brackets as though it was a scientific paper. In my opinion, that's pseudoscience and misleading. Is that the kind of thing that irritated you into writing your seminal blog post about Guy McPherson?
It is, yeah. That's one of the things, because it's misleading to the reader to not understand what that source really is, you know, and what it's about. And I've seen him point to kind of strange things like that. I've seen him point to, you know, kind of off-the-cuff blog post on some survivalist forum or something like that about how oxygen levels are decreasing and so people aren't going to be able to breathe soon. And there's just no credibility to that, but it's the kind of thing that he'll end up pointing to. And I absolutely agree that, you know, it might be okay to refer to that stuff if you're going to be upfront about what it is. But I think people have really been misled by getting that message from him. They don't understand what his sources really are.
Who is Michael Tobis, and where does he fit into this debate?
Well, Michael Tobis is down at University of Texas, I believe, Austin. I'm not sure. But he blogs at Planet 3.0. And he is also the only other person I've noticed sort of say something about Guy McPherson. And I think it's because Michael Tobis is active in the Global Warming Fact of the Day Facebook group, which some of your listeners may be familiar with. And he saw some of Guy's stuff popping up there. So he wrote a blog post after mine, kind of addressing a portion of Guy's argument that I had left out. And that's Guy's list of positive feedbacks. So he sort of makes this argument, you know, again, your listeners probably know, but positive feedbacks are things that amplify themselves and lead to making larger changes than you started with. And, you know, there are many of these well documented in the climate system. There are negative feedbacks that tone down changes too, but Guy maintains a list of some 30 or something, what he thinks are examples of positive feedbacks. And his argument basically boils down to, look at how many positive feedbacks there are, we are doomed. But there's no analysis of any kind in that. There's no accounting for the magnitude of an effect of any of those, you know, much less what they should add up to. And so Michael Tobis wrote a post where he tried to put numbers on some of those things to show that none of them, or indeed any all of them together, really add up to anything close to the doomsday picture that McPherson claims they do.
You know, there hasn't really been enough good science, in my opinion, on the combination of these feedback effects. It's something that I take from McPherson's work that it's something we need to look at. And it's true, in my experience, that most scientists focus on a particular climate vector. Very few are able to take on this whole complex of interrelated feedbacks. And maybe the models in science are just not that advanced yet. So I'm wondering if he isn't raising an important point here, whether each example holds water or not.
Well, I would actually disagree with that. I think, you know, it's true that some of these things we can talk about aren't currently simulated in global climate models, for example, but these climate models are very sophisticated and their entire purpose is to add all these things together. And I think that, you know, especially when you have these tremendous efforts like the IPCC reports, a lot of work goes into trying to assess that big picture, the additive effect of all these processes. It's one of those things where I think you can have an interesting discussion of the details of some of these things and what kind of impact they might have or how it fits into our understanding, but the reality of that situation does not come anywhere close to the extent that McPherson wants to present it as coming to. So these things might not be accounted for fully. That, you know, I don't think anyone would disagree with that. And you could talk about what kind of effect they would have, but they're just not going to add up to these extreme scenarios that he puts out of 4 or 8 or 20 degrees centigrade warming in a decade or two.
Right, and he doesn't put out a list of negative feedbacks, which are in fact helpful for us, the things like the ocean slowing down heating or whatever. So that sort of list should be published as well, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what would go into a proper analysis, right? We'd be putting numbers on these things and check both sides of the column and get an actual answer instead of just sort of a qualitative, it looks bad, which I don't think is very helpful.
This is Radio EcoShock, exploring the case that humans will not go extinct this century, as suggested by Dr. Guy McPherson. My guest is Scott K. Johnson. Well, now, Scott, Guy is worried about a rapid melting of frozen methane between both land and sea called clathrates. And the principal problem with the clathrate gun and the Arctic methane emissions in particular is that some of the science put forward by Dr. Shakova and her Russian co-workers is speculative. She says there's a possibility of a sudden 50 gigaton release of methane, perhaps after an undersea landslide in a critical area or something like that. And some people, including the journalist Nafiz Ahmed, writing in the Guardian newspaper, mistook this theory as fact. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. I mean, the work that those researchers are doing up there is obviously very interesting and very useful. But this might be one of those cases where there's so much interest among certain people in their findings that it's sort of being overanalyzed and overinterpreted. And, you know, maybe some of the things that have been said haven't helped or something like that. But some people take that group, their research to, demonstrate that some catastrophic change in the methane emission from that region has already begun and is increasing and that this is just fact when it's not. They've measured very interesting things. They've measured these plumes of bubbles of methane coming up from the seafloor in the shallow shelf off the Siberian coast. And they've been trying to quantify how much there is, where this is occurring, and that kind of thing. So many people think this sounds like it's, you know, the uncorking of the champagne bottle, and it's underway and you can't stop it. But the reality is that and I know you've had David Archer on your program to talk about this, and I think he detailed this very well, that there are a lot of complications here. We don't know how long these things have been going on. They're not necessarily new phenomena. They haven't been monitoring, you know, similar locations for a series of years to document changes. They've just found them. And so where these occur in other places, like off the coast of Svalbard, for example, research has subsequently shown that they're not a new phenomenon. At least there, many of those plumes of bubbles coming up from the seafloor have in fact been active for thousands of years, they found. And so it's very presumptuous to jump forward and say this must mean a catastrophic release is underway when we just don't know that.
Yeah, I was talking with a scientist about the East Coast where they found about 700 methane vents, but you know, it seems like they've just mapped them. They may have been there for a long time. They're trying to measure the calcium around them to see how long they have been going off. But it's not necessarily a sign that the world is doomed. And I'm wondering, from his writings, does it seem to you that McPherson realizes the possibility of a big methane release is speculation and not accepted by some other scientists? I mean, is there sound science behind Guy McPherson's claim that the fatal clathrate gun has already fired off?
No, I think that's maybe the weakest part of his argument as he presents it. There's just not much there.
Okay. Well, now, Scott Johnson, I'm wondering on another subject. Do you think there are gigantic reservoirs of methane down around the Earth's mantle just waiting to pop out if the permafrost cap above it is melted?
Yeah, I do not. That's not something that's ever been really seen. And, you know, I think that this entire idea, which comes from, is being popularized by the Arctic News blog people, is based on a single paper where a researcher sort of created methane from certain compounds under certain pressure regimes and, you know, used this to suggest that it's possible for methane to form in the mantle. It's not something that we really think is going on. That's sort of on the edge of the science there. And it wouldn't make much sense for it to kind of exist in pockets at that kind of depth. And it certainly wouldn't make sense for it to be connected by some series of conduits that's only corked by a thin layer of ice in the Arctic seafloor or something like that. So I think that's a very fantastical scenario.
Well, you raised the problem of people claiming that Earth is going to warm 10 or even 20 degrees C in the next couple of decades. In private correspondence, I asked former Clinton energy official and world-famous climate blogger Joe Rome what he thought about that kind of super climate change that Guy McPherson says is happening. Rome doesn't believe it. He points out the world is only warming at about 0.1 degrees C every 10 years, and even that's been slowed a little by ocean uptake. What are most scientists saying is going to happen as far as temperature increase over time?
Well, it's interesting that you asked Joe about that. I don't think anyone would accuse Joe of being conservative in that regard, so that's a worthwhile point to make. I mean, if you go to basically the sort of culminating effort of the climate science community is to put all this stuff into the IPCC reports, right? And I mean, what we're looking at in those reports, and we've been looking at for a while, is that under a business-as-usual scenario where we don't do anything to reduce our emissions, you know, we're looking at something in the vicinity of probably 4 degrees centigrade warming by 2100. You know, going back to what you were saying about positive feedbacks before, we can argue that there are some things not accounted for in that that may bump that number up, you know, maybe a few tenths of a degree, but it's not going to double it or triple it, which would still be short of what McPherson is claiming is, you know, sort of certain for our future. So those are the numbers that we're really kind of dealing with. It's very different.
Now, those are terrible numbers, and we're in big trouble as far as the world's crops and survival and heat deaths. I mean, it's an awful situation, but it's not necessarily extinction. Now, what source does Guy McPherson use to prove humans will become extinct if the world heats to 4 degrees C above pre-industrial levels?
I actually don't see any sources for that claim. I know he's very fond of a paper published a few years ago that was sort of a physicist named Kim Garrett who did a kind of what if the economic system is like a heat engine and we throw some physics equations at it. And so he said, I think that, you know, if you're going to reduce warming, you know, by any significant amount, that bad news for kind of our concept of industrial civilization and economic growth. But apart from that, which doesn't really address the extinction issue. That's one question about economic changes, and it's, you know, one paper, and it's not what, you know, economists would say, which is shouldn't be discarded. And there's nothing else that gets you toward why he says humans would go extinct. And I think he makes some vague sort of references to, you know, maybe you'll actually be too hot to live, which seems, again, kind of out there. But there's no analysis, no published science, nothing like that, sort of addressing this very difficult to answer question of, you know, under a scenario where you have extreme warming, what would it take for humans to go extinct? I don't think anyone knows the answer to that question. It's a very squishy kind of idea. Even if you go through some sort of huge societal collapse in this kind of, you know, post-apocalyptic sort of scenario, the actual extinction of humans requires something far beyond that. I mean, what does it take for the uncontacted tribes in the Amazon to die out from these things? I mean, there are these pockets that could live. So it's a very strange sort of question to try to answer, at least a difficult one. And I don't see any real evidence that he's marshaled to do that.
You know, several of my guests have explained a basic tenet of psychology and human belief. We have a nasty tendency to begin with a conclusion and then hoover up all the facts we can find to fit our belief. That's the way our brains seem to operate. And it could be the belief that climate change is a hoax or the belief that the end of the world is coming right up. In my opinion, science is an attempt to reverse this process to have our belief follow the facts rather than leading them. In your opinion, where does Guy McPherson fit on this axis?
Well, I think you described it perfectly. That's exactly how I think about it. Yes, it's a natural thing that we all do. We all get attached to our ideas. We all have our sort of cultural biases. I have them too. But I think if I can play psychologist, which is sort of dangerous, I do get the feeling that Guy had, in whatever manner, become very convinced of an idea, and that he has sort of plucked whatever pieces of information he can that support it, but ignores any pieces of information that challenge it. It's very apparent in sort of when you dig into the details behind what he's saying, and I think it does sort of explain his argument.
Well, I don't want to pile on Guy because he's been kind to me, and I've learned some things from him, and I think it's still worthwhile for people to examine his arguments for themselves, but you do point out that he's more lately got into kind of a conspiracy frame of mind. He says that Obama knows we're going to be extinct, but he's hiding it, and that other scientists who don't back him up are lying. That's kind of a worrying trend when we're looking at such a serious subject.
It is. That's always a red flag for me when we're accusing scientists of covering up information or being too cowardly to come forward with it. And, I agree. I don't want to pile on him too much. That's, I guess, sort of what I'm brought in here to do. But, I don't have any personal problem with him. I find him quite likable, in fact. But, I mean, this argument that he's pushing does have an effect on people. Through this sort of blog post that I wrote, which attracted far more attention than I ever expected it to, I've had a lot of people contact me. And, I've heard these stories of people telling me, my husband or my wife has grown despondent, they're depressed, they spend all day reading things that Guy McPherson and other people in that sort of frame of mind write. He's sort of become isolated and lost contact from the rest of us. And these are very sad stories. They're people who are literally selling everything they own and moving to a cabin in the woods because they're certain that all of humanity is going to die in a decade. I can't excuse that sort of impact you have on people. That's really negative.
It's a worry. One of Guy's friends, Michael C. Rupert, killed himself last spring, and I worry that if people are unstable or depressed and they fall into this thinking it's all over and start writing letters of goodbye to their kids, that's very destabilizing and kind of unreal. And it fits into a key archetype, I think, Scott, working through every age of the last millennia. Large numbers of people yearn for those questions and troubles of this world to be solved, hopefully before they die. And I mean, literally millions of people die disappointed that Jesus did not come back in time to end everything. And I think this dangerous tendency is starting to creep into the climate movement. Why else would 2,300 people join the near-term extinction Facebook page? It's pretty tough for science to argue when things become kind of a religion.
Yeah, and I totally understand where many of these people come from in seeing these sort of intractable seeming environmental issues that have grown over time and our apparent inability to take action on them and, all the political garbage that goes on. It's very frustrating and, it can be very depressing. But yeah, I agree that it's sad to see people hurt like that. It's not helpful to the situation either. I mean, at a time when we should be sort of pulling together and pushing to make progress, it's not helpful to be convincing a lot of people that they should just give up.
That's a key point. You know, if we accept Guy McPherson's message that we've already crossed the tipping point towards extinction, all that's left, he says, is to grieve and get as much joy as possible out of our last days. Well, that's always good advice, I suppose, but it demolishes any need for a climate movement, political action, investor responsibility, all that. No one knows the future with any certainty, so I think it's wrong to organize a campaign to persuade people to give up. That's one of my biggest complaints with Guy and this movement. Is it time to give up?
I would say certainly not. Certainly not.
Well, I predict that when 2030 arrives, there will be plenty of humans left in a world even more screwed up than it already is. And we can be sure of one good thing. Nobody will be denying climate change by then. But I guess when, you know, the followers of Guy McPherson will have moved on with their lives, how do you think people will look back on this sort of dark and confused time? Any guesses? I know I'm going well beyond science here, but how do you think it will look?
You know, I really don't know, obviously. But, you know, I don't want to overestimate the impact that it's had. I mean, there seems a very tight-knit community of people online who follow this kind of thing, and I think they're very deeply affected by it. But I don't think, I guess Guy's message is reaching more and more people as he, you know, gets radio appearances or things like that. But there aren't really that many people that have heard of him. And so maybe it's the case that this just kind of peters out after a while and nobody remembers.
We've been talking with Scott K. Johnson. He's a specialist in hydrology. He teaches geosciences. He writes about science. You can find his blog at fractalplanet.wordpress.com and his articles at the Ars Technica news site. Scott has bravely suggested humans are not about to go extinct anytime soon, or if we are, there is no serious science to prove it. Scott, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having the conversation.
I'm Alex Smith. I've just realized I said Malcolm Light's essay about flaming death and our extinction is not posted on the website of AMIG, the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. Actually, it's found on the Arctic News blog. Bloggers Sam Karana and Malcolm Light were part of AMIG originally, but they left over a year ago. These two things are separate, the blog and AMIG. I was also puzzled last week to hear Guy McPherson say University of Ottawa climate scientist Paul Beckwith predicts we will see warming by as much as 16 degrees centigrade in the next couple of decades. Here's exactly what Guy said on the program last week.
And Beckwith goes on a year later to predict 16 C within a decade or two. And so that takes us to, 2033, I guess, with 16 C. And that's the latest possible date for that prediction, would be 2033.
I checked this out with Paul Beckwith, and here's what he told me in an email, quote, "During the past, around 30,000 to 40,000 years ago, the Earth periodically cycled between cold glacial conditions and much warmer temperatures in the so-called Dansgaard-Oischer oscillations, DO oscillations. Typically, the temperature rise was 5 to 6 degrees C over one or two decades. The temperature would stay high for a century to millennia and then drop down again. However, there was one case where the temperature rise was 16 degrees C over a few decades. This data was obtained from the Greenland Ice Core records. Thus, the climate of the Earth has undergone very rapid temperature swings in the past, and is therefore capable of such changes again. I have also said that I think we are presently in the early stages of abrupt climate change, and could see temperature rises of 5 to 6 degrees in a decade or two." That's the end of a quote from scientist Paul Beckwith. You can see the difference from what Guy McPherson told us. Guy was careful to say up to 16 degrees, yes, but we are left thinking Paul predicts that will happen. Beckwith says it has happened in the geological record, and we are on the brink of some kind of jump in global mean temperatures, perhaps 5 or 6 degrees in a decade or two. That's far more than most scientists are willing to suggest, but I think Guy took some liberties to say Beckwith absolutely predicts anything like 16 degrees will happen. The picture we get is different from what the original scientist said in full, leaving us with an incorrect impression. And that's why we have to be careful with Guy's communication of what the science says. But I still think it's worth following up the leads that he presents us. We'll keep looking into Guy McPherson's claim that humans will go extinct in the 2030s as Radio EcoShock continues with a counterculture critic who has interviewed all kinds of doomers, but he thinks McPherson has gone too far. I'm Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock, and in my opinion, you haven't tasted alternative media until you've tuned in to the Sea Realm podcast. Host KMO holds in-depth conversations with an amazing roster of serious guests, some of them very well known. And by the way, C stands for consciousness. Maybe it's serendipity, maybe it's a strong movement in the counterculture, but completely independently, KMO and I were both preparing shows on the growing number of our listeners asking whether we humans are about to go extinct. That's mostly in response to presentations and speeches by Dr. Guy McPherson, formerly a professor of natural sciences at the University of Arizona. So let's get to it, KMO. Welcome, and I know you've covered this before. Why did you decide to look further into the near-term extinction idea?
Well, every few days I will get an email from a listener saying, hey, I just heard this really mind-blowing presentation by Dr. Guy McPherson. You know, why aren't you doing shows on this all the time? And, you know, I've had Guy McPherson on the Sea Realm podcast many times, a few times anyway, and I have let go some of his, what I thought to be more questionable claims about, say, Arctic methane positive feedback loops leading to global catastrophe in short order. But because so many people are taking it seriously, and because Guy McPherson is finding traction with this presentation to the point where he's giving a great boost to the Arctic News blog, and other people who want to do similar presentations are going to that same blog and presenting it as a credible source for scientific information, it seems like I do need to speak up and say something. Even though I know Guy McPherson personally, I've had drinks with him, you know, I've spent time with him face to face. He is an enjoyable person to be around. He is somebody that I like, but I have seen his dark side, and I don't trust his presentation any longer. I don't trust that he's giving it in good faith. And so I do need to say something.
Yeah, me too. And I feel exactly the same. I like Guy McPherson, and he's been nothing but kind to me. But there are problems with this. Well, for one thing, you know, I had a guest, Scott K. Johnson. I know you're going to have him as a guest. He's a science writer who has been critical of Guy McPherson's presentation of science. And one thing alarmed me, talking with Scott KMO, he's had emails from spouses or relatives of people who made big life changes. They quit their jobs, their relationships, or sold off their possessions based on what they heard. And they seem fixated on everything about our upcoming demise as a species and nothing else. It seems almost like a parallel to religious conversion to me, or maybe the most extreme preppers. What do you think?
Well, I went through a version of that myself with peak oil. You know, when I started the Sea Realm podcast, I was a married man with two children. And I still have two children, but I don't have the wife anymore. She was not willing to follow me down the path of really fixating on a fast collapse from peak oil, which I thought, you know, in 2007, 2008, when this was really firmly in my mind, I thought that, you know, by 2014, it would be all over. I thought, you know, the rubble would have stopped bouncing, as John Michael Greer would say, by now. And things just don't move that slowly. You know, the inertia of the current system and the real genius of capitalism in turning catastrophe into a profit center is going to keep things going. And I came to the conclusion that one thing you should never expect if you're doing long-term thinking and if you are thinking seriously about issues which need to be taken seriously and which aren't presented in any serious way in the corporate media, you have to let go of any expectation that you will be vindicated in the eyes of the people who doubt you. The processes move so slowly, and people's worldviews are so self-defending, so self-insulating, and so sort of homeostatic, you might say, that really there's almost no real-world event that is going to make the scales fall from everybody's eyes and say, oh, man, you were right. I was wrong. I'm sorry. It's not going to happen. So, like, when I first met Guy McPherson, he was very interested in peak oil, just as I was, and that was, you know, our connection. And he was certain that within 5 years' time, that the imperial system, as he describes it, and I don't dispute him, would have collapsed because of peak oil. Well, it hasn't collapsed, and it doesn't seem like it's going to collapse anytime soon. So he's changed his tune now to, well, it's climate change. It's going to take the whole system down. You know, within my lifetime, I'm going to see it happen. And it strikes me as being akin to somebody who's saying, this person that I really hate, my dire enemy, his life is about to be destroyed because the bad karma that he puts out into the world is going to come back to him. His wife is going to leave him. He's going to get fired from his job. He's going to be thoroughly discredited. And when that doesn't happen, to switch to a different narrative and say, you know what? I bet he's got cancer. I bet he's got terminal fast-acting cancer and he's going to die in the next 10 years. And then, you know, I will have been vindicated for never having, you know, been in agreement with this person or been willing to countenance this person's evil deeds. And that just seems to be what I see in this whole switching of narratives, just looking for the worst case scenario story that gets any sort of traction with an audience in the moment.
Well, you know, I want to get back to that. I want to get back to the big picture of what this really means, but I'd like to get to some of the specifics too about the science. And one of the things about not getting the scale of things right, which is what you were just talking about really, comes from Guy's use of this Arctic methane problem. And that's coming mainly from the Arctic News blog, but also from the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. Those are two separate things. But there are charts like those created by Sam Corana of Arctic News, but they fail to tell us that so far Arctic methane is just a tiny blip compared to our carbon emissions. We have less to fear so far from this amazing faraway maybe threat than we do from our carbon-based lifestyles right now. It's a distraction KMO that is, you know, taking people away from the factors that are really going to wreck our civilization and the natural world if we don't change.
I am not a scientist, so I cannot weigh in and say that I throw my scientific credentials and respectability behind one view or the other. But it does seem to me that the voices that are screaming the loudest about Arctic methane are not really well placed in the climate science community. And one thing that I'm seeing from Guy McPherson in his blog and in his presentations is he's sowing a distrust of the scientific establishment in general, saying that most mainstream climate scientists are too frightened or too venal to really rock the boat and say just how bad things are. And then he holds up these sort of fringe figures like Malcolm Light as the heroic truth tellers in the face of power. And that sort of insulates his entire narrative and the interaction between him and his audience completely from the scientific community, which it just doesn't strike me as a credible or legitimate tactic for somebody who's really interested in getting at the truth. It does seem like a very useful and time-worn practice for somebody who is looking to establish a cult of personality around himself.
Well, I've got two replies to that. First of all, heavy-duty climate scientists like Dr. David Archer and Gavin Schmidt, they've both been previous guests on Radio EcoShock. They've repeatedly taken these methane masters of frightened to task on the Real Climate blog. Methane is a serious concern for the future. They agree, but right now we should listen to real climate scientists, I think. But the other thing is I'd really love to talk to you and to your listeners about what I found out about Malcolm Light, and it's not great news.
I direct people to an episode of Radio EcoShock all the time in which you described Malcolm Light and his aims for harvesting Arctic methane.
Yeah, well, here, I'll just give you a little short piece from that blog, and here I quote, Malcolm Light's core article posted on the Arctic Methane Emergency Group website is titled Global Extinction Within One Human Lifetime as a Result of a Spreading Atmospheric Arctic Methane Heat Wave and Surface Firestorm. He's not a very good headline writer, but that's what he says. Now, I just had Guy McPherson on the radio show last week. I specifically asked him how he arrived at extinction in the 2030s. Guy says he doesn't calculate that date himself. He relied on outside sources, and when I asked him who, the only other person he pointed to making that prediction was Malcolm Light, who posts on the Arctic News blog. So Malcolm posts what looks like a scientific paper, complete with complex graphs and charts, and we find this stunning announcement there, KMO. He says, quote, the absolute mean extinction time for the Northern Hemisphere is 2031.8, and for the Southern Hemisphere is 2047.6, with a final mean extinction time, as though that really has any meaning, for three-quarters of the Earth's surface of 2039.6. Well, that's so precise, isn't it? In August 2031, say goodbye to all of us in the Northern Hemisphere. You know, I can't call that a paper until I find evidence it was peer-reviewed or published in an official journal. And, you know, I've been since told by Paul Beckwith that Malcolm Light's no longer a member of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, but he's still on this very unrelated Arctic News blog. And that's it. That's the basis for Guy McPherson's claim for extinction in the 2030s, and he's sticking to it, despite warnings from myself and many others that this isn't science at all, KMO. It's fantasy.
Well, he knows it's not science, and he's not doing it for science, but there are a lot of people who are anxious to hear this message, and I don't blame them. I mean, there are people who are very frustrated with the way things are. They do not find industrial society to be providing them with any sort of meaningful life experience. They don't think that there is any prospect for justice or for a course correction in their lifetime. And the idea that none of it really matters and that the evildoers will be extinguished along with everybody else soon enough for us to see it and savor their defeat is a very attractive prospect. And so, you know, I don't fault people for gravitating to that narrative, although I do fault people who propagate that narrative when they should know better.
Yeah, Malcolm Light's a petroleum geologist. He didn't work directly for big oil companies, as far as I can tell. His employer was the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas in Austin. But he has these wild ideas, like he's going to stop the methane threat, you know, by getting every oil and gas rig we can stuff into the Arctic and try to drill out the methane before it can escape. It would still be a global warming gas when we burn it in the U.S. or Europe, but hey, at least we get to burn it before it creates more warming. That would be silly stuff if it wasn't so dangerously misleading. He has ideas to use radio waves from HARP to zap methane out of the sky. You know, this stuff, we can't take this as the only source for humans going extinct in the 2030s and take it seriously.
What's more, you know, he gives these mean extinction dates for various hemispheres to 1/10 of a year accuracy. I mean, scientists don't make predictions like that, but there is a class of people who do make predictions like that. They predict disaster to the hour, and those are people who are noodlers with, numerological noodlers with biblical prophecy, or people who claim to have received their information from aliens or from channeled spirits. I mean, there is a long tradition of predicting the end of humanity to the hour, but scientists don't do that.
I asked Guy what he meant by extinction. Does he mean most humans die, or would there be a few left in caves or around the Arctic Ocean? You know, James Lovelock suggested that. His exact reply was, quote, "I'm a conservation biologist, and when I say extinct, I mean every member of the species is gone. That really strains my belief."
Mine as well, but, we are not his target audience.
I suppose so. Now, he's also woven the risk of nuclear power into his story of our end times now. You talked about him switching narratives. And he's right to say if the global electric grid goes down for any reason, if it's a massive collapse or a solar flare or a big nuclear war, then, you know, there's 400 nuclear reactors that could melt down like Fukushima. But we don't know that that will happen. And I think even if it added a million or a billion cases of cancer, that's not enough to depopulate the whole world, much less cause our extinction. And that's my opinion. And I'm dead set against nuclear power. I think they should be shut down as soon as possible. But again, it's an exaggeration.
I agree. I was reading earlier today, and I'm afraid I can't cite the source, so I can't credit the person who made this this comparison, but about 20,000 people died as a direct result of the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown. And there's something on the order of 400 nuclear plants in the world, so 400 times 20,000 is a lot less than 7 billion.
Yep. And another exaggeration that has a partial truth inside it, he says the oceans are dying. Just point blank, that's it. The oceans are dying. But you know, I lived near the ocean for 25 years, and I know that isn't true yet. You know, a growing chorus of the best oceanographers do say ocean acidification from our carbon pollution will change the food chain in the seas. Maybe we'll get a whole lot of jellyfish instead and acid-tolerant plants. But I haven't found one ocean scientist that says the ocean is dying right now.
I fear, though, that a conversation like this, like there's a climate march coming up in New York City next week.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend, who knew that this conversation was going to be taking place, was very concerned that it not take place just before the climate march, because even poorly constructed narratives that don't have any substantial backing to them, if you debunk those, then it's easy for people to take you to be saying that things are fine. That, you know, all of this concern about climate change or destruction of habitats or resource depletion or the health of the oceans, you know, this is all just overblown hype. And it's not. We have serious, serious issues that we need to address in a serious way like adults. And I really hate to be the one who is saying something which could be taken out of context and used by climate deniers or by people who are boosters for business as usual. So I don't say any of this lightly. And so talk of the oceans dying. Coral reefs are certainly dying. Fish stocks are being depleted. You know, the plankton are still doing their job, and the basic fundamentals of life and the cycles of life in the ocean proceed, but that doesn't mean that everything's okay.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing that we have to worry about, there have been mass extinction events, even in the ocean. There was the Great Dying about 248 million years ago. About 96% of all ocean life died, but it took a long time. It happened over a couple of million years. It certainly didn't happen in a couple of decades. So we think there are huge problems, KMO, and they're coming on faster than we expected. The climate's more sensitive than we thought it would be. You just got all these crazy rainstorms in Phoenix and Las Vegas and New England and, you know, popping up in England all over the place. But we're not going to go extinct in two decades, and I think that's what you and I agree on.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, another key argument that Guy McPherson makes is his list of 37 positive feedback events. And those are forces that tend to feed themselves, driving global warming even faster. For example, reduced sea ice leads to ocean heating and even more sea ice melting. But there's two big problems with Guy's presentation of these feedbacks. First of all, he doesn't tell us there's another list, and that's the list of negative feedbacks. Those are the things that tend to limit these climatic events or these big changes in the environment. And again, you know, I'm not saying that positive feedback effects aren't important and that they aren't scary. They are. But there are other parts of the picture that he's leaving out. And I think it's responsible of you and I and anyone in the media to give both sides of the story, not in the sense of, okay, we'll let the climate deniers get on here and give us some baloney, but the fact that nature is a complex system and there's a lot of things going on. It isn't all one runaway climate change and that's it for all of us.
Yeah, I agree, and I don't really have anything to add to that. I think you're absolutely right. There are two lists and he only presents one.
Yeah. And there is a science-trained blogger named Michael Tobis who I sort of recommend. I don't like his style, but I do like what he's researched. And he was a university academic. He's writing at planet3.org. And he's looked into these positive feedback effects that Guy McPherson lists, and he finds the total possible impact of these feedback loops is not powerful enough to generate the kind of runaway climate change that Guy McPherson is talking about. They're bad, and we don't know how bad yet, and scientists are still studying that, but, you know, even the worst case scenario, we don't get wiped out this century by the things that he's talking about. You know, KMO, I'm kind of reminded of that net viral video where a guy films this triple rainbow and he's blubbering the whole time. What does it mean? You know, what does it mean? And that's where I'm stuck with this near extinction thing. What does it mean? What did John Michael Greer have to say about all this?
Well, I've actually been paraphrasing John Michael Greer for much of our conversation. Basically, just that Guy McPherson, as a scientist, should know better than to do what he's doing. John Michael Greer has had, I think, the tact to not speculate as to what Guy's actual motivations might be. I have speculated a bit. I have heard from people who claim to have been horribly mistreated by Guy McPherson, and I have seen him respond to people who are asking very reasonable questions with just attack. And this is largely what prompted me to start saying something out in public. He attempted a character assassination against Nicole Foss, and, you know, from there he started to report that she had said things that she had certainly not said, that she was advising people to buy gold, you know, to survive the crash, when she says nothing of the sort. You know, she says the exact opposite, that gold is the last thing you want. You don't want to be sitting on a big stockpile of gold, you know, at the time in a really destabilized period. You want relationships with people that you trust and who care about your benefit. You know, who care about your well-being.
The other thing that I would say publicly, KMO, is that his later writings, his most recent writings, have a kind of paranoid twist to them. I mean, he said, for example, that President Obama knows that we're going to go extinct, but he just can't tell the public about it. He's made other claims that seem to say there's a vast conspiracy and that perhaps he's involved in it or the people are against him for that reason. And this worries me. And, you know, Guy has talked publicly about the stress that's been put on him by this realization that he claims that, you know, that we're going to go extinct. It's a very tough thing if you come to that conclusion and then you think, well, you know, my kids or all the people I love, everybody, our future doesn't mean anything. And that's something that I think all his listeners are going to have to deal with. And I've said elsewhere that I think it could even be a mental health issue for some people if they are already feeling suicidal or weak and they hear this message, well, it's all over. Maybe bad things could happen. And I think we have to take responsibility for what we say to people. And I often think that about Radio EcoShock too, you know, and I've tried to always allow a way that we can turn this into a positive thing, that we could make a better world, that we can grow things locally, that we can do something ourselves rather than just leave it like, well, we're all doomed, as Guy McPherson does.
I think he would disagree with you on that point, but I don't know how he could justify that disagreement. To say that we are all doomed and there's nothing that can be done to save humanity from going extinct within the next two decades, that is a position of, that leaves his audience in a position of utter powerlessness. The only thing that they have any control over is, I think, as Guy would say, you know, the integrity with which they live their lives, which basically negates the ongoing efforts of anybody who is struggling to effect long-term change, anybody who is struggling to make political strides, you know, to advance progressive causes. In a scenario where we're all dead in two decades, no matter what, all of that is meaningless. There is no reason to continue. I don't want to say that even if we are all doomed in two decades, I would want to keep it secret. That would certainly feed paranoia. But you know, there is a certain wisdom to that line.
Yeah, I wonder if I came to that conclusion totally, I might just stop broadcasting and start growing my potatoes only. But I think that Guy McPherson and Carolyn Baker, they're choosing psychology as an answer along with spiritual counseling. Guy took a quickie counseling course and now offers himself as a kind of life coach, although I guess you'd call it a life extinction coach. He's also coaching people on how to homestead for the last days. He's just come back from doing that in Belize. I'm expecting this near-term extinction movement to move from claims of science towards overt religion. That's my prediction. Maybe my prediction will avert that from happening, but I think that's where it's going to go.
You know, if it's headed that way, I don't think your prediction will head it off. I think that, and I don't think Guy is the only person who is doing this. He's just the figure that you and I are most familiar with. But I think that as the doomsayers move in intensity and gather a larger audience, an audience who doesn't have much patience for scientific talk for the most part, that in spite of their stated intentions, it will move in the direction of a more obviously faith-based narrative than this pseudo-scientific narrative that it exists as right now.
We're so fascinated with this stuff. We've got world disaster movies in the last couple of decades, cheap television fare. Why do they make those shows and why do we flock to watch them?
You know, today's See Rome podcast was an interview with the editor of the Encyclopedia of the Zombie, and I don't know the full title of the book. But modern life, really, it doesn't provide much fulfillment for many people. A lot of people are very frustrated, and they think that they envision a scenario in which civilization collapses, but they band together with a group of other survivors and they fight off the undead, or they, you know, they fight off the mutants or whatever the threat is. And the threat of something that wants to eat you, when it presents itself, you either get eaten or you go into the fight or flight response mode and you leap or you fight or you do something which resolves the situation. And it's resolved. I mean, it's resolved. You escaped. You defeated the monster or whatever. But in modern society, your ability to fight or flee or, you know, do something ingenious in the moment doesn't save you from having to pay taxes or go back to that job you hate again and again and again. And the manager who's in your face and who is belittling you and who is giving you a really unfair performance evaluation, that guy, you can't just kill that guy, as satisfying as it would be to do so. And in the zombie apocalypse, you do get to kill that guy. So it's not a mystery to me why that is so attractive. That's why I have science fiction writers on the Sea Realm podcast. It's why I have horror writers on the Sea Realm podcast, because the C stands for consciousness. And I'm interested in not just spinning some scenario which is plausible and I'm presenting as, you know, a bona fide prediction, and this is our entry to the dark side where we get to play with these ideas. I'm saying we have a natural tendency to gravitate this for very particular reasons. And let's set aside plausibility for the moment. Let's talk about the dead rising and civilization falling from that and see why it is so satisfying for us. And I think that if Guy and people who are on a similar trajectory would allow themselves to actually step into the realm of admitted fantasy from time to time, that they might be able to find something there which satisfies the ache, the need, the yearning that drives him to, you know, put his credibility behind this obvious pseudoscientific nonsense.
I think, too, the near-term extinction movement partly comes from the nuclear weapons standoff that many people grew up with, because our grandparents went through the First World War, the Depression, the Second World War, and they never thought that any of that would end the world. It wasn't until we actually had the ability to end the world with massive exchanges of nuclear weapons that we really thought we had that kind of power. And I think that kind of power is now being attributed to whatever, peak oil, to climate change. Without nuclear weapons, I'm not sure we'd be having this conversation.
Although the scary thing about that is the nuclear weapons are still there. The threat of nuclear annihilation has not gone away. Even though it seems we had the opportunity to make it go away, that opportunity has been squandered.
Yeah. So what do we say to our listeners who write in, they want more news about Guy McPherson and our upcoming extinction?
Well, as I say, I have been directing them to a previous episode of Radio EcoShock, where I think that you did a very good job at showing just how thin a source Malcolm Light is and how little reason there is to take him seriously. I think I will probably in the future be directing people to this blog post by Scott Johnson.
Yeah.
And Scott Johnson has a network of fellow science bloggers who have also taken up this cause. And I think that there's a fairly substantial body of work that people could read, which is pretty convincing that this presentation that Guy is giving has very little to do with science and a lot to do with psychological needs, which are left unmet.
Yeah, let's see. Scott K. Johnson, you can Google that. He's on Fractal Planet. .wordpress.com. I think that's his address. Or you can Google, will humans go extinct soon? And believe it or not, you'll see my blog just under the Wikipedia entry for human extinction. So it's right up there. People are checking it out. You know, I think Malcolm Light is about as serious a scientific source as Bernie Madoff was a good investment advisor. And I make no secret of that. You know, I'm going to have to wrap up my part of this conversation. We're sort of reaching the time limit that I have for Radio EcoShock, but tell people how to find your podcast and, you know, how they can tune into what you're doing.
Well, it's very easy. It's the Sea Realm podcast. That's the letter C and then a dash and then R-E-A-L-M. So it's searealm.com. And if that's too much typing or too much to remember, just type KMO podcast into Google and you'll find it.
Right. Does KMO stand for something? Are we allowed to know what it does?
Kevin Michael O'Connor.
There it is. All right. And, you know, I'll put a link to any extra audio in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info, too. People can find this whole thing there. I really appreciate talking with you, and I hope we're going to chat again. You know, you used some insight that set me on some new paths about this whole subject.
Well, I have found your show very enjoyable. I've spent a lot of time with it on long road trips, and it didn't occur to me until just today that we hadn't actually ever spoken.
No. No, I feel like you're a friend of mine, but here we are talking for the first time.
Yeah.
The media is like that. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, there you go. First a program making the case that we will go extinct, and now two voices who disagree. You, of course, will have to make up your own mind. At this point, it's impossible to prove who is right. As you can tell, in my untrained opinion, which isn't worth any more than yours, our problem is not that we risk near-term extinction, but that we will have to struggle on for generations through a terrible shift in our climate, a growing shortage of energy and materials we now take for granted, and the general degradation of the natural world, including the extinction of many species. That is bad enough. I can't explain why I believe humans will continue and even find pockets of happiness in the decades and centuries to come. I can't even explain why, in the face of scary news all around, I feel happy most days. It's harvest time. Our kitchen and canning pots are flooded with food. I get to phone up some of the brightest minds in the world and talk with them on your behalf. Computers let me write the music I've always dreamed of. My family's doing well. Some people say I should be grieving, but I feel joy. Others say we should give up, and right from my core, I say never. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our world.